I don't think I've ever spoken to a room this big, but anyway, thanks for coming. I know it's beautiful out there. Why are you all here? Hearing about grief, you could be on the beach. Anyway, I'm really happy to be here. I love this convention. I've been coming here for many years. Have a lot of history here. Am I too loud, or can you hear me? Speaking for the microphones very well. Anyway, we're all here to hear about grief and recovery. And I was asking the other day, people came down here with, well, there's all sorts of grief, right? Grief of a relationship ending. There's grief of, you know, for me, it was the loss of my 20s. I don't really remember them. You know, there's lots of kinds of grief. And this one very wise young woman said, there's other meetings for that. And you know, she said people come to this workshop to hear about the grief of someone dying. Have a, you know, personal, tragic kind of grief. But okay, I'll tell my story. I know a lot of people know me in here and have heard my story, and a lot of people are part of my story. But I'll start kind of in the beginning a little bit. Well, first of all, how many people have lost someone close to them? Figured that's why you were here. Okay, I don't feel so alone, so thanks. I got clean in Boston in 1985. I met my husband, Kevin, who I will call him, when I was 30 days clean. Wasn't like that. At least my first one wasn't like that. Second one was, but anyway, I met him when I was 30 days clean, and it was my first NA meeting ever, and I thought, you know, there might be something here. We didn't get together then, and I met his sister at the same time, and we became friends, and then I met Kevin again 3 years later. He had 4 years clean, I had 3 years clean, and we met, and like good addicts, 6 weeks later, I was in Virginia.
In Winchester, Virginia.
And I spent the next 20 years in Winchester, Virginia.
Having kids, finding kids,
raising kids, being married. You know, Kevin, he was everything I, you know, was looking for at the time. We were both in our mid, late 30s, and neither one of us had ever been married. Didn't have any kids, thank God. I didn't have any kids when I was using. So we had a lot in common. You know, we came from similar backgrounds, similar places. We got married. When we did, we knew that having kids would be difficult. We tried anyway. We tried a lot. And we wound up, to kind of make a long story short, traveling around the world to find our kids. We adopted three kids. My girls are from China. Adopted May in 94, Leah in 95. They're both 18 right now. And my son Chase in 97. He's from Cambodia. And, you know, it was the first time in my recovery and in my life that
I followed a path
that I knew nothing about. You know, it was a way, it taught me how to let go
and let God, because I had
no idea what this was going to look like. And, you know, we found the kids we were supposed to have. We found our kids.
And it was a long process,
and it was a bit of a scary process. But, you know, we were both clean. We had 6 and 7 years clean at the time. We had a big network of people. How many people in here knew us then? Yeah, we had a big network of people. A lot of support. When we came home from China with May, it was the days you could go to the airport. You know, you could actually go to the gate. And there must have been 40 people.
Right, really?
40 people. Huey made this big banner. We had balloons. There were people that didn't know us hearing about our story and crying in the wings. You know, we got off the plane. It was just, you know, she was 3 weeks old. It was incredible time. And, you know,
We did that together, you know, so we made our life here. We made a life in NA. We made a life with our kids. We made a life in Winchester, Virginia. NA was the most important thing in our lives, but we also had big lives in the community. Kevin owned a commercial real estate company. Kevin was a very ambitious, come on, other adjectives, difficult, loving, caring, very involved in recovery, sponsored a lot of people, had was the chairman of Edge Hill Recovery Center, so very involved in service and very involved in the community. And so recovery was not a secret to the people in our community. We it was, everybody knew that he was in recovery, and but it was a great, you know, he was somebody that could pull it off, you know, pull off having a big life in the community and having a big life in recovery. But he was challenging. He did a lot. He demanded a lot from people. He loved his kids. He was an amazing father. He was an amazing husband. He was a challenging husband. You know, a big part of our lives was staying fit and, you know, doing a lot of things with our kids. And Kevin played tennis and he ran. And when our kids were 2, 5, and 6, the girls were 5 and 6, Chase was 2, he played tennis every Monday night. And he took Lear to the tennis court that night, and he died before he hit the ground. He had a heart attack and died. So needless to say, he died suddenly. And I was talking to a friend this morning. She also kind of had a tragic sudden death in her life, and we were talking about what that was like, you know, what that kind of grief is like. You know, we've all had our own grief, and I'm not here to say that it was any better or worse or different, but kind of it set the tone for my life for the next 12 years. This was 12 years ago in 2001. And, you know, one of the things I realized that grief has given me, because, you know, I've been around long enough to know that I have to find the silver lining in everything. And one of the things that grief has given me is opportunity. You know, it's given me the opportunity to grow, to change, to see life in a whole different way. And it's been a process, you know, like anything else in recovery. And I was, you know, they asked me to share about this 2 months ago. So for 2 months, I've been thinking about grief. And I realized, you know, the stages I had gone through in the last 12 years about that. And it was real, at first I was kind of pissed. I was like, why does this have to be front and center in my head every single day? You know, anything time my kids did something great, I missed their father, you know, it was just... but I came to look at it as, you know, it was really a gift to look back over the last 12 years and see, you know, why grief was a good thing. You know, I know that sounds kind of crazy to say, and if I had to go back, I wish he had never died. But I choose today, like a lot of things in recovery, to find the gifts in it. You know, and a friend of mine was also sharing at her anniversary recently, and she didn't really talk about her mom's death, but she said, you know, it's kind of like shit happens. You know, and in recovery, shit happens. And grief is one of those things that happen. And, you know, the way I survived it was with you. You know, and I still survive it. You know, people that raised their hands earlier that knew me then, that's how I dealt with grief. That's how I survived it. And in the beginning, it was shocking. It was absolutely shocking. And my brain just stopped. You know, I couldn't make sense of it. You know, it was like when you see something really horrible, your brain wants to think it's something else. Do you know that feeling? And then I couldn't believe it for years. You know, every once I would stop short and go, really? This really happened? And I couldn't believe it, that he was gone. Because, you know, like all the people we love in our lives, they hold a place in our life. And when they're gone, there's a void. You know, there was a big void. And, you know, Kevin was a dad of three young kids. He ran a company. A lot of people depended on him. He had, I don't know, how many sponsees did he have at the time? 5 or 6 or 7. I felt like they were often more important than me, but that's another topic for a meeting. So there was this void. I mean, there was like this empty space, you know? And for me, it was that space that I've always felt a little empty, you know, the hole I kept filling in my addiction, you know, trying to fill the hole and feel normal and whole and whatever. So there was this void again. And so the first phone call I made was to that man back there, Huey. He was Kevin's best friend. And I called him, and I don't even remember what I said, but I didn't say he was dead because I didn't know it at the time. And Huey said, "I'll be right there." So that phone call triggered, I don't know, 40 people at my house within an hour. You know, Huey drove this big old motorhome, and there were 40 people in my house. I wasn't alone for 3 months, I don't think. You know, it's 16 people at dinner every night. And for those first couple of months, it was just, you know, I really didn't have to pay attention to my grief so much. It was about my kids. It was about you all that were there. Because everybody struggled with it, you know, it was shocking to everybody. So I got to kind of still be the mom and take care of everybody, take care of their feelings. You know, I wasn't really taking care of my feelings. And the way I took care of my feelings, I ate. I went back to my first love, my first addiction, and I ate. And I ate. And I basically, the only thing I could keep in my brain, like I'd be standing in a group of people and my best friend would be there and I wouldn't remember her name. So I'm so glad you all have name tags. Because it's still kind of a disconnect for me. Right? It's still a disconnect. I mean, I'll be standing around people I know and I'm going, "Oh shit, I gotta introduce them. What's her name? What's her name? What's her name?" Yeah. So all my friends know if I don't introduce them, that means I've totally forgotten. They should do it themselves. So, you know, that was one of the things that, so, you know, kind of my brain shut down. I knew where my kids were. Every minute of the day, I'd go through and I'd say, okay, they're in school. Where they are. I knew where they were. I couldn't play the radio. For some reason, you know, my brain had stopped functioning at a level that I was used to it. And I didn't play the radio in the car because it was too much noise. And I guess that's a self-protection, you know. It protected me from having to feel or think too much at one time. And so I ate till I weighed, I don't know, 230 pounds. And I had 15 years clean when he died. He had 16 years clean. And so 3 years later, I had, I don't know, 17, 18 years clean. And I got to the point that I felt just like I did when I got clean the first time. I was using. I was seriously using. I was ways and means to find something different to take me out of myself. And I was so worried about my kids at the time, too. My daughter, who was with him at the tennis court when he died, I don't think I went to the bathroom for 2 years without her right here. You know, she was 5 years old. You know, and I was so concerned about my kids because, you know, we adopted them from China and Cambodia as babies. They had already lost a set of parents, you know, and then they lost another parent. And here I was eating myself to death. You know, I wasn't thinking, I wasn't feeling. Nobody could get close to me. But they still kept coming around. You know, they showed up all the time. Dragged me to meetings in that damn motorhome. I was like, oh. So that was great. So where was I with that? Oh, so I was just so concerned with my kids. And my daughter Leah, She walked, and they, you know, every night they went to bed, they asked where their father was. And I didn't know how to explain that to them. But I did, you know. I just talked to them. I don't think I talked much to anyone else except to them. And I just told them whatever came up. You know, I more than anything, I don't know what they heard, but I more than anything wanted to keep his memory alive for them. And also let them know that they could ask me any question they wanted to about death, about what that meant, you know. So, you know, we formed a relationship that we never would have had if he had lived. You know, we would have had a different great relationship if he had lived. But, you know, we formed a relationship that we wouldn't have had if he had lived. I formed relationships with people, Kevin's best friends, that are still my best friends today, and, you know, half of them are sitting here, that I wouldn't have had otherwise. You know, so I'm so grateful for you guys in my life. And, you know, these guys helped me raise my kids. And I'm going to brag about them for a minute, so I'm going to stop crying long enough to talk. My oldest graduated from Baltimore City High School last year, inner city high schools, and she's a freshman at Johns Hopkins on a full scholarship this year. I'll play this tape for her. My daughter Leah is a senior in the same school, senior in high school this year. She's graduating with, I don't know, 4.4 or something. And she's going to Bucknell University on a scholarship. Yeah. And my son Chase, oh, he's the best. He's 14. And, you know, I think he misses his dad the most. It's been hard. You know, raising him without his dad, not been hard. I mean, we have an incredible relationship, and he has incredible relationships with men in this country, but I'll tell you the story. He's getting 14, he's getting a little hair on his upper lip. I'm thinking, this boy's gonna have to, you know, among other things that I don't know how to talk to him about, shave one of these days. And so, we're in Target, and he goes, Mom, I need a razor. And I said, yeah, I guess you do. I said, and I'm thinking, I'm walking down the aisle really fast going, how am I going to teach this kid how to shave? I never even thought about this. It's something I'm going to, you know, have to bring him to Huey's house, and he's going to have to show him how to shave. And so I turned, I said, so, you know, you don't have to learn how to shave. He goes, I got it. I know how to shave. I said, how? How do you know how to shave? YouTube. YouTube. My son knows how to shave. I hate to think what else he knows how to do. And you too? Yeah, I know he knows how to put a condom on or something like that, I'm sure. Anyway, so I burst out in tears. You know, it was just very sad to me. I'm crying, walking down the aisle. And he goes, I know, Mom, I'm growing up. I know, it must be hard for you growing up. And then I started laughing. I said, yeah, that's true, honey, but you learned how to shave on YouTube. You know, it was just like, it was, thanks, John. There's no tissues up here, do you believe this? John went to the ladies' room, men's room, got me tissues. So, you know, all the gaps that I've had in my life in recovery, and especially, you know, with the death of my husband and the death of my kid's father, have been filled by you people, you know? And sometimes it's not the same. It's just not the same. And, you know, I'll be at a game with them, and my son, he sprained his first lacrosse game of the season, came down after a shot that he made, and rolled his ankle, and he's in a cast for 3 to 5 weeks. And, you know, at that one, I had these moments hit me, and I was like, oh my God, I need someone to carry him off the field. Who's going to carry him off the field? And I felt so alone. I felt, where's his dad when this happens? You know? And, you know, I'm the kind of person, I immediately snapped out of it, and I found someone to help me. You know, I'm really good at putting people together, you know, because I know it's a thing that's going to keep me alive. And I learned quickly after he died that this thing works, and what they say about a network, and what we say about a network, and finding people in our lives that have us, no matter what, is true. It works. And it's not, it was no longer intellectual for me. It was real, you know, because I got it on a really real level. And that carried into the rest of my life, you know, and I got on a real level that anybody will help me if I need it. And I used to travel to Boston with them where my family was. Three kids in car seats. I'd have two car seats, three kids, three toddlers, and going through the airport. And people would just help, you know, and I would ask. You know, the one thing I learned around here is to ask. I asked. I used to call Hugh up and say, you have to come help me put them to bed. I can't do it by myself. Then I'd be dragging the trash down the road, you know, to the corner, because all the shit that they did, that they're gone, you know, and I'd be crying going down the driveway, and I'd call people, and they'd come over and do things for me, and I had to ask, because in the process of grief, after the first couple of months, when all the work is done, and, you know, they've been buried, and you've been busy doing that shit, then real life sets in, you know, real life set in, and I had so many people to ask for help. And so for me, the best piece of advice I ever got from someone, I didn't know it then, but I knew it now and I knew it afterwards, was when you're willing, get as many people in your life as you can. You know, force yourself to be social, force yourself to make friends, to go out to dinner. And you know what? When I was new in here, I didn't have a checkbook. I didn't have a house. I didn't have a car. I had time to go out with people and hang out with people. And so that was the best piece of advice. So if I can give anyone advice, which I really don't like to do up here, is get people. Get people in your life, you know. And if the group of people you're with or some people don't work, find others. There's tons of us out there. We're not going to like everybody, you know. Not everybody's going to have our back. People are going to talk about us. People are going to do shit. You know what? It's life. Just get people. You know, I don't, because, you know, seriously, people in these rooms have saved my life in a very real way. So I made some really bad choices after he died. Stop laughing, Huey. I made some really bad choices. And this 5-year-old daughter of mine, who is an incredible kid today, smart, funny, annoying, exasperating, difficult, challenging, lovely, she, oh my God, I lost my train of thought. What was I saying? Bad choices. Yeah, thank you. How could I forget? Am I out of time? Do I have time left? 5 minutes? Phew. I don't have to talk that much about my bad choices, but I made bad choices. And one of them, a big one, was my daughter, she was 7 or 8 at the time. She wanted a dad. I wanted my kids to have a dad. I was really missing the fact that they didn't have a dad. You know, I didn't sign up for raising 3 kids by myself. Not how I wanted to do it. And I liked being married, you know. I liked the whole family thing. So I found a volunteer. Yep. It's a really, and, you know, and he had very little time clean. He's a little bit younger than me. And my kids adored him. And when it got to the time to cut or go, you know, to make it happen or go, they adored him. And I couldn't go. I just couldn't. So we got together, we lived together, we put our houses together, we got married in spirit. You know, we got married on the beach in Aruba and didn't really get married, thank God. It was the best decision I made. I made a lot of bad ones, but that was a good one. And I pray for him today. He's using, took him about 3 years. You know, I picked him up, brushed him off, micromanaged his life. You know, that's my part. And all I can do is take care of my part today. And I, you know, did damage control. And all the people in my life did damage control. My kids lost another father figure. I did damage control. I don't know how else to put it. And, the best thing I did for anybody in my network, in my circle, I was honest about my feelings. I learned how to cry in here. You know, that man back there taught me how to laugh loud and cry hard. And that's what I learned how to do through this process. I also discovered who I was again. Because, you know, when you're married, you kind of tied up with someone else. I lost myself a lot. I had 3 young kids. I was an at-home mom. I didn't know who I was. That was a scary part, too. So, you know, in these rooms, you know, I worked the steps. I was treated like a newcomer. I was a newcomer again, really. And I worked the step, and I figured out who I was, what I wanted in my life, how I wanted it to look. So I guess if I can leave with anything, it's that grief was an opportunity for me, you know, to feel my feelings, to get to know people in a whole different way. People show up, as you know, in a different way, you know, when you lose someone. Some don't show up. You know, some can't. And I didn't begrudge them that. You know, some people just can't show up. It's a very hard thing to do. And but a lot of people do. And so thank you guys for showing up and, you know, being here. I'm the kind of person that can feel alone in a room full of people. But I don't feel alone today. So thank you. Love you.
Thank you, Patricia. Our next speaker is Lise Kay from Dulles Corridor area, and she's going to share about mending relationships.
Hi, I'm Lise. I'm an addict. I first came into the program in 99, but my clean date is September 20th, 2006. So I struggled a lot getting this program, and a lot of it was I saw myself so much different than everybody else. I had used for the same reasons all of us use for, but I had been sort of the good girl my whole life, the responsible one, the smart one, the trying to be in control of things because my dad was an alcoholic, so I was trying to just have this very controlled life. And I think I felt good about myself because I was the good girl and I got good grades. I think I was an addict from the time I was born, probably. I just channeled it into other things. I channeled it into school, things I could control. And when I was in my early 30s, I had a bad injury and I was prescribed painkillers, and we all know how that's gone for many of us. And within a period of about 6 months, I had started forging scripts because I had worked in healthcare, so I knew how to do all that. And I just disconnected from the law-breaking aspect of it. Just the insanity of it just kind of took over. I ended up arrested a couple times. I ended up with being in jail briefly, treatments, not getting it, because most of what I focused on was saving my face and not saving my ass. That's what somebody told me about, that I was so concerned with damage control and that I looked okay and that I needed to get back to be the person that I used to be because I was the good girl, so I didn't have to be this drug addict person. And I really was convinced I could do that, which was why I didn't get clean. Why I didn't really get recovery, why I kept relapsing after a certain amount of time. I treated recovery like it was a class. I really did. I read the steps. I worked them without a sponsor because I didn't feel like I needed it because I understood it. I mean, there was a huge disconnect from, it was a huge disconnect from what, you know, where was I at? Like, I didn't know. I had a counselor ask me one time, like, who are you? And I quickly did that, gave it back to her, and she said, these are all the things you do. Who are you? And I really and truly didn't understand why she didn't see that I had already done what she'd asked me to do. But I just didn't get it. What some of us, I think, needed the not the easier, softer way. I had that presented to me multiple times that I didn't take. And I ended up in 2006, I was coming home from this convention and forged a script on the way home. Now, that's insanity of this disease. It took me a long time to admit that's what was going on. But I looked good on the outside. That was my MO. When I used, I didn't use during the daytime. I used at nighttime when everybody was asleep. And nobody knew, so I thought. I was a good mom. I coached my kids' soccer. I baked cookies for the PTA. I did all those things. And nobody really knew. But at night, that was it. It was a whole different world. I did well in my job. I mean, there were so many things that I could say were not, that really wasn't a huge problem for me because things were okay. I had good relationships with people. I wasn't pissing people off. I wasn't stealing from people. Well, I was. I did steal pills from neighbors, but they didn't always know about it. But at the time, I wasn't pissing people off. So after I forged that script, and my story is kind of the same. It's just, it's how long does it take me to get arrested? That's about the deal. Because, I mean, I was really good at it. Like, we're all good at it. I think we're brilliant people if it gets channeled in the right way. But eventually I got caught. I was glad I did in the end because I didn't have to keep the secrets. But then everybody knew. And I remember being in jail trying to use the phone and work this story so my ex-husband would not find out what happened. And like that I was someplace else for the night. I mean, it was just crazy. So in a way, when I came out and all my secrets came out, I had little kids at the time. In 2006, I had a 9-year-old, 7-year-old, six and a half, like 4-year-old, two boys and a girl. And they were very protected from my using in that they were asleep. But there was a couple times when my one son found me asleep on the toilet before because I would, you know, take pills, get a whole hell of a lot done because I had ADD and I didn't know it. And then eventually I would fall asleep. Lots of times I would fall asleep on the toilet. And he'll still talk about that. But for the most part, I prided myself on I really didn't screw up relationships. Well, I did in a lot of ways. I just didn't get it till I had to go to federal prison because I forged scripts in two states. And that was what I needed to do because I couldn't take care of anybody else. I'm also in a helping profession. That was really helpful, too, to keep away from myself. And I had to sit there, and all my secrets came out, and everybody knew. And there was no way you could hide. It was in the newspaper. It was completely... I was not a good girl anymore. And in my mind, and being a good addict and an adult child of an alcoholic, I have a lot of black and white thinking. You know, pass, fail, good, bad, 110. There was no middle ground. And so once I got arrested and everybody knew, it was everything good I'd ever done was gone. Like I could never, ever be okay again. And that kicked my ass in recovery for a long time because I couldn't forgive myself. I couldn't have a relationship with myself. None of that. I got married right out of graduate school. I was 23. My husband was 22. I did all the things that I thought would make me happy. I got a husband with good EP earning potential, I thought. He was a good guy. Got the house, the kids. I worked, stayed home with my kids. It looked so great on the outside. And it was great. But I wasn't happy. But I didn't get that it wasn't about the stuff on the outside. And my husband, he's a great guy. We have a great relationship today. I'm just lucky in many ways. But when I called him from jail the first time in 99, that's how he found out I had a little problem. And he said, whatever it is, we'll get through it. Don't worry about it. And he really thought it was a thing we could fix and I would be back to the girl who had it all together. And it was far from that. And as that progressed and the years went by and we bought a house and we were getting ready to move and he said to me, don't embarrass me. That's what he said before we moved. Because he was really concerned because that's what happens. I get arrested and people find out about it. So I was going to be the good girl again. It was all going to be fine. And it didn't. And we separated in 2002. We ended up divorced, but I had to move out of the house into an apartment. He had the nice house with the kids and I was devastated, and I never thought that I would be okay again. So going to federal prison, I went to treatment, a 90-day program, and I did what they told me to do. For the first time, I kind of really did listen to what they told me to do. And I remember being in this one group and wanting to be promoted to the next group. And the big sticking point was I didn't think that my addiction had really affected my children, because I had protected them, and being a good mom was really kind of the most important thing to me. And they kept me in that freaking group for so long. I finally said, why am I not out of this damn group? And they said, because that relationship with your children, you don't get it. You don't get that you weren't present. I'm like, I was definitely present. I was at this soccer game. I was here. I was there. And that is the whole thing. Like, what does it mean to be present? And to have a relationship with anyone in my life, I have to be present like this. And that was what I didn't do. I remember reading stories to my kids. You know, bedtime stories were always really important. But I remember if they picked a long-ass book, I was pissed because it meant I couldn't use. And I want them to pick the short book and hurry up and that's great, night, night, and let's go. And that was not present. And my kids felt that angst. And I know I was irritable. I know I was rushing. I know I was not there because I was thinking about how many aliases I had and which pharmacy I need to keep it all track at and where I was going to go in between everywhere else. So that really helped me to get it. And I think once I got that part about what does it mean to be present and show up. And we hear that all the time. Suit up, show up. Yeah, I showed up. But once I got what that really meant, that was an opportunity. And the night before I went to prison, I was in a 90-day program, and I found out kind of with short notice that I had to start serving a sentence. The next day, I couldn't finish treatment. My kids did not know that I had been arrested, none of it. And fortunately, they came in. My ex-husband, who I have a great relationship with today, came in. My boyfriend at the time came in. And I had to tell my children and that was the lowest point of the low. And, you know, my daughter's over there combing the hair on this Barbie doll almost the whole time because she just couldn't get what this all meant. And I didn't let them come see me in jail. I wrote them all the time. And then I got out. I went to an Oxford house, even though I own my own house, because obviously what I was doing in my own house was not so helpful to me because that's where I use, by myself in my house. So when I came back trying to build relationships, repair them, I was so still kind of shame-filled because everybody in the community kind of knew about it. And my kids play a travel sport, and it was a hot freaking topic at the hockey rink. Like, I walked in there, and everybody would sort of look at me and judge me. But I was fortunate to have this ex-husband who was able to see that our children needed a mother and that his role could be to really screw me over, and or his role could be to help me in whatever way he could to be a mom, but it also meant he had to keep my kids safe from me. And the idea that needed to be done was beyond me. I wasn't unsafe. I didn't drive under the influence. I'd use till 4 a.m. and take him to school at 7, but I really wasn't using driving them. Stuff like that. And so I was really big on, well, I didn't do that. I didn't do that. Well, I did. Yeah, I did. And it ended up that I wasn't allowed to drive my kids anywhere for a year. My boyfriend could, and I could ride in the passenger seat, but I couldn't. And that was humiliating. But you know what? This one time, after being in federal prison, that was good for me. I knew that was not God's plan for me. No way. And I knew that my way didn't work. I had spun it all over the place. I had used all this education I thought I had that was so great, and that's what screwed me the most. So I just did it, and I was humble. I knew what everybody was telling me in these rooms, that if you do what you're supposed to do, things get better. Like, you can heal relationships. They can't be the same relationship, but you know, I didn't want them to be the same relationship. That to me, mending it wasn't fixing what was broken. It's like rebuilding it into something that was better. And my ex-husband and I are great friends today. We shouldn't have got married. We should have been really great friends and stayed that way. But he brought my kids to see me in treatment. He, you know, let them come over if I had supervision, all of those things. And I remember with my kids, like, they, when they would leave, they'd say, are you coming back? And, you know, are you going to be late? I'm late a lot from the ADD. I'm not late today because I'm using. That's somewhat. But they really had trouble with that whole dependability. Was I really going to be there? And just knowing that it wasn't what I said, that I'm sorry. I said sorry to everybody, but I didn't do anything different. And then when I started to do things different, I wanted everybody to know this was different. Yeah, it was, I had 2 hot minutes clean and I was really fixed. But it just took a long time, and I was lucky. I have a family that's very loving and supportive and that wanted to help me get back on my feet. I had a master's degree. I do have a master's degree, but I was painting decks with some other people in recovery, which was very humbling and very glad I did that. But I had to do all those basic things. And in the process of that, I got to forge a different relationship with my ex. We went to therapy together about sort of the ending of our relationship, kind of having closure on that piece of it, but how to co-parent together. He forgave me. He still gets a little tweaked sometimes. We went away to take my son to college, and we went together. I drove with them. Like, who does that? And I was having a really hard time that night, something to do with my boyfriend, of course. And he ended up texting me and said, "Do you need to talk? Yeah, I'm here for you if you need to talk." I didn't talk to him, but I could have. I know I really could have, and he would have been there for me. And he could hate me. He could have taken my children, and that would have been the end. But he was able to rise above that, and I was able to show up. And each time I do, it does get better. With my boyfriend at the time, I was so focused on his not working a program that I ended up getting real caught up in that and didn't do my stuff, and that has a lot to do with why I relapsed. It's not his fault, but I lost working on me. And the whole trust thing that got blown out the window after that. Like, who's going to trust you? Because I lied well, just like many of us do. I was really good at it. And people don't believe you. So it was just showing up and doing it and being humble and hating it in many ways. But I really did believe that God's timing, as much as I think it sucks sometimes, I know that from my experience in life that when I look back, I understand why things had to happen a certain way. Like, it wasn't what happened to me. It wasn't being in jail. It wasn't all that. It's what I chose to do with it. And especially with people in my life. For me, connections with other people give life meaning. And if I didn't have that, I didn't really have life. And I thought I had all of that, but they weren't based on truth, none of it, or honesty. They were based on what I wanted people to think I was. And I don't have a problem today with walking in the ice house where my kids skate. And if everybody knows about it, so what? But it took this piece away from me of, like, trying to put all that energy into, look how good I look. I mean, good I look in terms of coming across well. And I was able to have authentic relationships. Building back trust was really hard, but the simple part is, like, if you show up, like, really show up, then that gives me the opportunity. The biggest relationship, to be honest, that I mended was with myself. I didn't have a relationship with myself. The more I did, the better I was. That's my operating principle for years and years. And having to kind of do that and look at sort of who you are. How do you tick? You know, yeah, you're a mom, but what is it about being a mom that feeds your soul? What is the piece of it that really enables you to have relationships with other people? So I started working on that. I started being honest in the rooms instead of just acting like, here I am, let's, you know, I really got honest. I used to make note cards to lead meetings. I swear to God I did. Like, if someone gave me a topic, oh, well, let's talk on acceptance. I would, like, go into meditation books. I'd make little notes beyond the notes I make today. But these were, like, so it was like a presentation. And I wonder why I couldn't stay clean. Like, really? That's, to me, today, it just baffles me. But I just started being honest with my kids. I started trying to just be there and do simple things and look at them in the eye, and same thing with the rest of my family. And they supported me and helped me sort of crawl my way back out of this hole. The relationships I have with people in recovery, I mean, I had relationships, but it wasn't like they really knew. I was the one who, like, yeah, I'm okay, how are you? Because I work in a field where that's what I do, I help other people. So I can keep really far away from myself in the bestest way possible by helping other people. Then they say thank you and I feel good about myself, but then I lose me. I should have gone and gotten 3 years backup time for my probation violation after the federal prison stint. And for whatever reason, it's a God thing to me, I didn't get the judge who originally sentenced me. Never happens. Usually you go back to the judge who you violated with, who had said to me a few years before, if I ever see you back in this courtroom, I will not even breathe once before I send you downstate. And I knew that would happen, but it just, by a chance, this other judge was there, and I got this opportunity to mend the relationships, to get to know myself, to accept that I was never going to get back to the good girl that I thought. I could be a good girl again, but it didn't mean what it meant before. And that if I could do that, then my relationships were going to be a hell of a lot better. I still, like, struggle with some of those. I still have the same boyfriend. I have a lot of issues with trust. He went back out. That was a fun thing to be on the other side of all that. And seeing like, wow, I probably screwed up, how I screwed up relationships by defensiveness, by blaming other people for why I was, if you didn't do this to me, then this wouldn't happen. And, you know, just not being reliable, just not showing up, you know, those kind of things. Or I'll be there in a little while, I got delayed, I'm late here. It took so much of my energy to work all of that. Like, how the heck could I really have a relationship with anybody? I mean, with all the aliases I had, first of all, that was enough to keep track of. But today, let me just see how much time, sorry. Okay. Today, my oldest is 18. He's a freshman in college, plays hockey at college, has fairly okay grades. Loves the fraternity life with the solo cups and almost every picture on my Facebook feed. So I took him out of that, which helps a lot. But a good kid, hasn't really been in a lot of trouble. My middle son's in 10th grade. He's plays hockey also. They all, you know, my boys love me. They talk to me. They don't punish me for who I was before. It comes up sometimes, and especially with my kids at the age where they're exposed to a lot of alcohol and drugs. And I talk to them, and they'll say, I remember, like, you're a different mom when you came back. Like, you did stuff with us. Well, I did stuff with them before, but their perception was that I didn't. And that's a huge change. And if someone had told me back then, well, yeah, you're not really a good mom, because look at these things you did, I would have said, oh, yeah, I am. That's the badge I wear. I'm all these things, but I'm a good mom. So that's, to me, the number, besides the relationship with myself, the relationship with my children. My ex-husband and I get along great. It's almost incestuously weird, to be honest. He remarried, had another child who's 5, who calls my mother grandma also. She thinks I'm like the fun aunt. It's literally, she comes to our house. But, you know, I look at it and I feel so great about it, because who couldn't have enough people to love them? I wish I had all those people. Who cares? It's society that makes you think, why do you like your dad's ex-wife? It's not her. I could seriously go on vacation with him and it would be fine. And, you know, we have our moments and stuff, but I'm not defensive to the degree I used to be. That was the thing, always protecting my secrets. And he was better than me. And when we met, I was the smart one. I was the good one. And I was sitting in the library at college, and people would say, well, why did you first were attracted to Lisa? And he said, I saw her studying in the library. She looked like such a bitch. I had to have her. And it was because I was the together one. He meant I was focused and that, but I was the one who had my shit together. And then I didn't. And he used to call it my fall from grace. And somebody in treatment, a counselor said, you know who falls from grace? I said, who? He goes, perfect angels fall from grace. And that's where you think I didn't think I was perfect, but that was what I was trying to get back to. And I had no chance of ever making it in recovery with that attitude, and no chance of having any real relationships if that's where I was. So kind of getting past that, and he still tries to define a lot of what's the right and the wrong way. But today I'm not invested in him defining me anymore. So I'm grateful, and I know from my experience that if I wasn't coming here, wasn't hanging out with people. I'm not going to as many meetings as I need to today because of a lot of demands of my life. But at the same time, like, I know that's going to kick my ass in the end, because people don't know you. You don't have relationships with other people. In the end, that's how I skirted out of it. So I'm grateful to this program, and I'm grateful for all of you letting me talk. Thanks.
Thank you, Patricia and Lise, for a great message. Let's thank them both for sharing. I think we do have some time left if anybody else would like to come up and share.
I'm Moselle, and I'm an addict.